In a logo, a fishing bobber drops into a pool of blue water which reflects a crescent moon. Our view soars up into the sky where a boy sits on the moon's edge holding a fishing pole. Amid billowing clouds, we float past giant block letters. DreamWorks SKG. Now, an animated logo appears in three-dimensional gold letters. 20th Century Fox. Spotlights on either side of the logo point skyward and wave back and forth. A News Corporation company. Now, credits appear on a black background. DreamWorks Pictures and 20th Century Fox present a Zanuck Company production. Tom Hanks as Michael Sullivan. Paul Newman as John Rooney. Jude Law as Maguire. Road to Perdition. Now, a boy stands on a beach with his back to us. He looks out across a lake as waves gently lap along the sandy shore.
There are many stories about Michael Sullivan.
The boy holds his hands in his pockets as our view moves closer.
Some say he was a decent man.
He wears suspenders, a white shirt, and knee breeches.
Some say there was no good in him at all.
The sun hangs low in the cloudy horizon, filling the sky with a pink haze.
But I once spent 6 weeks on the road with him. In the winter of 1931.
As wind rustles the boy's dark brown hair, the picture fades to white.
This is our story.
Now the boy comes into view riding a bicycle over the crest of a snowy hill. Falling snow obscures the background as he pedals downward, leaving a snaky line in the white powder. Later, near brick factory buildings, the boy rides past workmen carrying lunchboxes. More credits. Jennifer Jason Lee. Stanley Tucci. Daniel Craig. Tyler Hoechlin. Liam Aiken. Dylan Baker. Sharon Hines. Casting by Deborah Zane, CSA. Now, standing beside his bike, the boy sells newspapers. The long line of workers trudges on through the snow. Icicles hang from one warehouse roof. Now, the boy rides along a hill, passing two smokestack towers. Later, he pedals down a city street. Cars pass on either side, their long running boards white with snow. Wearing a scarf wrapped across his nose and mouth, the boy glances to his right, then coasts to the curb. A storefront awning reads Peerless Pharmacy. The boy enters and sets his newspaper sack on a counter. The store owner pulls out the remaining papers and counts them as the boy plops down some coins. The owner adds up the change, gives the boy a sidelong glance, and heads down the counter. The boy quickly slips a pack of tobacco from a display into his pocket. The owner returns, opens a cash register, and hands the boy some money. The boy heads out. He sticks a pipe in his mouth and retrieves the tobacco from his pocket. Later, he rides down a residential street, letting out puffs of smoke. He turns into a dirt driveway leading to a two-story house. A younger boy steps out from behind a tree and hurls a snowball. As it hits the older boy, he falls off his bike, then gets up and reaches into the snow. The younger boy pitches another snowball into the older boy's chest. As he falls, he throws one of his own. It hits the younger boy, who topples onto his back. A woman with dark, wavy hair watches through a window, laughing. The older boy turns his head, then gets up and hides the pipe under his shoe. A green sedan passes by on the driveway. The woman behind the window checks her hair as the vehicle's reflection appears in the glass. The younger boy chases the car as it pulls into a garage. The older boy watches from the yard. Later in the kitchen, the two boys sit at a table doing homework. Their dark-haired mother works at the sink. The older boy glances up at her, then looks back at his textbook. Beneath it, a blank page in a notebook bears a handwritten heading, Math. The boy looks at his younger brother, who diligently writes in his own notebook. Their mother glances over her shoulder as the older boy buries his head in his hands. She steps behind him and leans down over his shoulder.
I'll help you with it later.
Go fetch your father.
She kisses his cheek. The boy heads up the stairs to a hallway, then stops, gazing into an open door at the opposite end. In the room, a mustached man removes a necktie and lays it out on a bed. The boy takes a hesitant step closer, watching his father remove items from his pockets. The boy blinks as the tall man folds up rosary beads in his hand and sets them down with the other items. He then reaches under his suit jacket, pulls out a pistol, and removes the clip. The boy watches intently as his father takes off his jacket. With a tentative gait, the boy approaches, his eye level at his father's waist.
Pa?
His father hesitates, then lays the jacket down over the gun. He removes a cufflink.
Dinner's ready.
The father unbuttons his vest. He pulls it off and disappears behind the half-open door. The boy heads back toward the stairs, his hands in his pockets. He glances back briefly over his shoulder. Later, in the dining room.
Bless us, O Lord, for these thy gifts, which we are about to receive through the bounty of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
The four family members cross themselves, then begin their meal. Daytime. A pair of legs trudges across a snowy walkway to the car. The elder son climbs into the back seat.
Michael?
Sir?
It's awake, so I don't want to see those dice.
No, sir.
His father gives a curt nod, then faces forward in the driver's seat. Glancing in the rearview mirror, he watches Michael sit patiently. Later, their green car turns into a gated driveway. People walk from parked automobiles to a large three-story brick estate with two front spires. Now, inside, Michael and his family head from a coat rack to a sitting room. Behind them, another family enters, and a maid takes their coats. Michael and his family turn toward an anteroom where flowers adorn an open casket. As they head past the curtain doorway, the younger brother stops and tugs on his mother's dress. She turns to face him.
I don't want to go. Come on, it's all right.
No, I'm scared.
She stands back with her younger son as Michael and his father kneel at the casket and bow their heads. Michael's gaze falls on the large chunks of ice surrounding the wooden casket. Underneath, water drips into a pot. Michael looks to his father.
Ice helps preserve the body.
They bow their heads again. Michael opens his eyes. He glances at his father, then peers over the side of the casket. Inside, coins rest over the eyes of a man's corpse. Michael stares raptly, then notices his father crossing himself. He quickly does the same, and they both get up.
So, who's got a hug for a lonely old man?
A white-haired man holds out his arms. The boys
now
rush
then,
over.
Which is which? Don't help me. Peter and
he points them out.
No!
He looks to their parents.
Maya, good to see you. Did you bring the necessary?
Yes.
If you'll excuse me, I have urgent business with these young gentlemen.
He smiles at their father as he follows them. Sullivan rolls his eyes. Now a pair of green dice skips across a tile floor.
Yeah! Winner!
All the cops! I know hustlers when I see them.
Oh, hustle, old-timer.
Man. The white-haired man pulls Michael down beside him on a crate.
Upstairs. Jacket pocket in my study. Before I change my mind.
Now Michael climbs a staircase. Upstairs, the young boy walks a long hallway furnished with wooden chairs and settees. Large wooden columns adorn the textured walls. After passing several doors, Michael approaches one and opens it. Inside, a man lounges on a leather couch with a lit cigarette in his hand.
Hello.
Hello.
Remind me, which little Sullivan are you?
Michael, sir.
Sir. You don't have to call me sir, not your pa.
No, Mr. Rooney.
Call me Connor. You know, call me Uncle Connor.
The boy smiles, then fixes his gaze on a gray coat slung over the back of a chair.
What do you want?
Mr. Rooney sent me to get his jacket.
Connor stares off, then looks at Michael.
You come back later. I'm busy.
Yes. Sir.
Michael hangs his head and leaves. On the couch, Connor takes a drag on his cigarette, then exhales a swirl of smoke. Downstairs, Rooney taps a glass with a spoon. A crowd gathers.
I want to welcome all of you to my home. It's good to have so many friends in this house again. Since Mary died, it's just been me and my boy rattling around in these rooms. I had this speech prepared, but it would be dishonest of me to say that I knew Danny well. But lose one of us, it hurts us all. I tell you what I do remember, though, and Finn will remember this, too, and that's Danny on the high school football team, a championship game, down 6 points, 10 seconds left to play, 4 yards to go. Danny tackles his own quarterback.
A dark-haired man shifts on his feet and stares tight-lipped at the ground. Sullivan eyes him.
You know, we all make them. God knows. Let's drink to Danny's honor. Let's wake him to God and hope that he gets to heaven at least an hour before the devil finds out he's dead.
Amen.
Danny!
The mourners raise their drinks. Rooney sips from a liquor bottle.
And now, I would like to ask a dear and a trusted friend, Finn McGovern, to say a few words. Words that I'll wager got more poetry than mine. Get over here.
Rooney motions to the dark-haired man, Finn, who steps before the crowd. Connor and Sullivan make their way forward, their brows furrowed.
Thank you, John.
Finn's gaze drops to a paper in his hand. It quivers as he reads.
My brother Danny wasn't wise, nor was he gentle. And with a skin full of liquor in him, he was a pain in the ass. But he was loyal and brave. And he never told a lie. He'd have enjoyed this party. Me and the family, we want to say thank you to our generous host. Where would this town be without Mr. John Rooney? God love you.
The elderly man raises his hand and nods his head. Finn pockets the paper.
I've worked for you for many years now, John.
Finn faces Rooney.
Nearly half my life.
The elderly man stares intently at Finn.
You never had a disagreement.
In the crowd, Connor and Sullivan watch.
I've come to realize that you rule this town as God rules the earth.
Sullivan edges toward Finn.
And you take away.
Lovely.
Sullivan shakes Finn's hand and abruptly escorts him out. Connor and the other men follow closely. Michael cranes his neck to watch, then trails behind them. Outside, in the driveway, Sullivan holds Finn's arm as they approach a car. A man gets into the driver's seat as Sullivan opens the back car door. On the front porch, Michael and others observe. Finn faces Connor.
I'm going to bury my brother, then I'm going to deal with you.
Sullivan puts him in the car.
Just take care of all of us.
Don't you get a good night's sleep.
As the car drives off, Rooney approaches his son and Sullivan. He looks at Connor.
You all right?
Yeah, he's fine. It's too much to drink. I'll talk to him.
Take Mike with you.
No, Paul, I'm fine.
Take Mike with you. Just talk, nothing more.
Rooney leaves the two men and heads back to the house. On the porch steps, Michael turns and goes inside. Sullivan glances over with a furrowed brow, faces Connor, then walks toward the house. Inside, musicians play as the crowd dances. Holding hands, rows of men and women face each other in pairs as they step backwards and forwards in an Irish reel. Smiling brightly, Peter dances in one of the rows. A young girl approaches Michael, who sits on a chair. She takes his hand and he rises, shaking his head. As she presses her hands together, Michael shakes his head again. Across the room, Sullivan stands against a door frame. As he sets down his empty plate and napkin, a little red-headed girl dances with the crowd. The dancers stand hip to hip with their arms around each other's waist and spin in a circle. Rooney smiles as he watches. Among the dancers, Annie spins around in the arms of a blonde man. Her husband watches as she throws her head back and laughs while her dance partner twirls her about. The dancers stop as the musicians take a break. Now Rooney sits at a piano. Sullivan approaches, takes a seat beside him on the bench, and places a hand on the keys. They play together, both looking at the keys as they each maneuver a hand across the keyboard. As Sullivan creates a melody with the upper keys, Rooney follows on the lower keys. The crowd grows still as they gather around the two men. Nearby, Connor stands with his arms folded, watching the pair. He nods his head lightly to the music. Her wavy, bobbed hair trimming her face, Annie tilts her head as she leans against a wall and smiles pensively at the two men. Connor smiles as he stares at his father and Sullivan. His smile slowly fades. He drops his gaze, then quickly glances around at the crowd and smiles again. Sullivan looks to Rooney, who marks the final note with a quick nod of his head. The younger man takes a drink as Rooney puts his arm around his shoulder. In the crowd, Peter tugs on Connor's shirt. The man looks down at the little boy.
Why are you always smiling?
Connor leans down and meets Peter's gaze.
Because it's all so fucking hysterical.
Peter stares blankly into his face. Connor walks off. Now in his bed, Michael uses a flashlight to read a small, thick book.
What?
Peter sits up.
I had a nightmare. It was about Mr. Rooney's house.
Peter squints as Michael aims the beam in his face.
It's just a house. A big house. Go back to sleep.
Peter lies back down. Across the bedroom, Michael returns to his reading.
Is Mr. Rooney rich like the babe?
Richer. Are we rich? No, stupid.
Michael turns a page to a picture of a shadowy figure entering a window.
What's Papa's job? He works for Mr. Rooney.
Why?
Well, Papa didn't have a father. So, Mr. Rooney looked after him.
I know that, but what's his job?
Michael lifts his gaze from the book. His eyes shift in the dim light.
He goes on missions for Mr. Rooney. They're very dangerous. That's why he brings his gun.
He turns to the next picture. The figure is the Lone Ranger.
Sometimes, even the president sends him on missions, because Papa was a war hero and all.
You're just making that up.
I am not.
As the flashlight beam hits Peter's face, he lays back down again.
It's all so fucking hysterical.
Michael glances quizzically at his brother. Morning. Sullivan makes his way down the stairs and into the kitchen. He joins his two sons at the breakfast table.
Peter, I can't come to your concert tonight. I'm working.
Peter and his brother trade glances.
Working at what?
Annie looks up from pouring coffee.
Putting food on your plate, young man.
All right, boys, come on, clear the place.
Peter takes his breakfast dishes to the kitchen sink. Sullivan pulls him over for a hug as Michael watches.
You're a good lad.
Michael's eyes follow his brother out, then return to his father. Now, in a classroom, Michael sits at a desk, staring out the window as boys at other desks write studiously. Later, back at home, Michael coasts his bicycle to a stop in front of the garage. His ears are covered by flaps on his tweed cap. As a puff of breath steams from his mouth, he looks thoughtfully at the closed blue doors. He pushes forward again and pedals along the snowy driveway. Later, rain falls heavily outside the garage. Sullivan's head bobs outside the windows as he approaches the double garage doors and eases them open. Studying a key ring, Sullivan passes the car to a cabinet at the back of the garage. He pulls a leather suitcase from the cabinet, then a small circular case from a shelf inside. Now the car eases out of the garage, its headlights shining in the bleak twilight. A single overhead wiper blade pushes the rain aside on the windshield as Sullivan stares stoically ahead. Later, the car pulls up to a large building. A figure exits under a lit sign that reads, Hotel Florence. He makes his way through the rain to the passenger side door and gets in. It's Connor. As Sullivan pulls away, Connor takes out a silver flask and offers it to him.
No.
The car turns a corner on the dark street.
We're just talking to him, right?
Sure.
Connor places a cigarette in his mouth and tosses the empty pack over his shoulder onto the back seat. As it bounces on top of the leather suitcase, the top of the bench seat slowly rises like a lid, and Michael peeks out of the hollow compartment. Michael's view through the gap shows Connor and Sullivan watching the road ahead. As the car makes its way through an alley, the headlights turn off. It turns the corner, driving alongside a huge brick warehouse. Michael eases down the seat top as the car pulls to a stop. Sullivan reaches back and takes the circular case and suitcase off the seat. Inside the seat, Michael listens, keeping his palms on the lid. Sullivan returns the suitcase to the seat and the two men exit the car. Outside, Sullivan shuts the door, holding a Tommy gun. As they stride ahead through the rain, Michael's head inches up over the seats. He watches them as they continue on, then crawls into the front seat. Getting behind the wheel, Michael peers through the fogged windshield, then wipes the glass. As he watches, the door leading into the warehouse closes. The boy blinks and leans back against the seat. Opening the car door, Michael steps out into the rain. He walks carefully up to the warehouse doors and peeks between them. The view through the crack shows rows of wooden kegs. Michael leans back and looks along the outside of the building. He spots another wooden door with light streaming through jagged breaks at its bottom. Hunched over, the boy moves to the door and lowers himself to the ground. Light from inside the warehouse spills over his face as he lies down in the rain and peeks in the hole. He sees Finn smoking a cigar in the center of the warehouse, sitting next to Connor.
Don't get me wrong, Finn. I feel for you. I do. I can't let a thing like that give you cause to go mouthing off. You're my dad. You go back many years, and he is a just man. So what do you say?
Connor rises from his chair and moves next to Finn.
Come on now, Finn. Make this easy.
Sullivan steps in front of the hole. His pant legs and trench coat frame Michael's view of the two men sitting beside a crate.
We can't hear you.
Connor leans over Finn's shoulder and the older man puffs his cigar.
All right.
Good. Thank you. And I am sorry. I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for this misunderstanding. And I'm sorry your brother was such a fucking liar.
My brother was not a liar.
Excuse me?
Two of Finn's thugs enter.
Protect my family and keep my job. I'll stay quiet, but don't think I don't know something's going on. And don't think I won't find out what it is.
Whoa, what is...
Sullivan's stance widens abruptly.
We're just talking. You tell your father my brother never stole from him. I've checked the books. He never sold no booze to no one. Every single barrel's accounted for. Anyway, if he sold it, where's the money?
Fuck should I know? Did you check his mattress?
Or maybe you should check yours.
Well, there is something immoral here, don't you think so, Mike? My beloved father throws your undeserving little brother the wake of his life, and this is your thank you? What a hideous world this is.
You think you're so smart? You think we don't know? I mean, you've been spending so much time in Chicago.
Connor puts a bullet in Finn's temple. In slow motion, Finn falls from his chair. Outside, Michael stares wide-eyed. He covers his ears as dozens of bullet casings fall around Sullivan's feet. When Michael looks again, one thug stares lifelessly, blood covering his face.
What was that?
We're out of here.
Jesus Christ, Connor, what the hell are you thinking?
Connor aims at Michael. As Sullivan spins around, Michael backs away from the broken door. Outside, he runs from the building to a nearby gate. Sullivan bursts outside into the rain and chases after him. As the boy huddles on the ground against the locked gate, Sullivan stops.
Michael! Are you hurt?
Michael glances up and shakes his head.
You saw everything?
As he nods, Sullivan tilts his head and a stream of rainwater runs off his fedora.
Jesus. You are not to speak of this to anyone. You understand? Not to anyone.
Who's this?
Connor walks over.
One of yours?
He must have been hiding in the car.
Well, can he keep a secret?
Sullivan looks hard at Michael.
He's my son.
The two men lock eyes. Connor nods.
Well, that's good enough for me. You take him home. Take a walk. Perfect night for a stroll.
Connor glances at the boy, then turns away. Sullivan watches him walk off through the rain. Connor raises his arm and waves his fingers without turning around, then pulls his collar up tighter. Later, Sullivan backs his boxy green car into his garage, watching over his shoulder through the rectangular rear window. Sullivan puts the car in park and shuts off the headlights. He and Michael sit staring ahead as water drips off the windows.
Does Mama know?
Your mother knows I love Mr. Rooney. We had nothing. He gave us a home. A life we owe him. Do you understand?
Michael gazes out his window.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Come on inside.
Michael gets out of the car after his father. Later, in his room, Michael stares up at the window's light shining on the ceiling. The rain rippling down the glass makes the image wavy. In the garage, Sullivan closes his Tommy gun case. He opens the wood cabinet and places the suitcase back on its shelf under the round drum magazines. He shuts the cabinet doors and secures it with a padlock. As he presses the padlock closed, Sullivan's hands grip the edges of the cabinet and he rests his forehead against the wood. Morning. Michael sits sulking at the kitchen table as Peter eats his breakfast. Michael watches out of the corner of his eye as Sullivan enters and takes his seat across from his sons.
Boys, clear your plates, please.
I'll do it later.
It's time for school now.
It's only a plate!
Michael storms away from his seat. Peter puts down his napkin and bolts from the table. Sullivan stares at the tabletop as Annie gets up and moves to the window. Outside, Peter runs up to Rooney. Peter. Sullivan moves beside Annie and looks outside.
What's he doing here?
Michael was hiding in the car when I went out last night.
Jesus, Mike.
I've spoken to him. Won't happen again.
Sullivan leaves the window. Michael walks his bicycle off the porch as Peter runs back toward the house. He slows as Rooney approaches with his arms open wide.
Just the fella.
Michael stops and Rooney leans down to him.
Our secret, right? I'm talking about the dice. A man of honor always pays his debts and keeps his word.
His blue eyes fixed on Michael, Rooney holds out a silver dollar. Michael stares at it, then takes the coin and pockets it. Rooney smiles.
I'm going to be late for school.
Michael gets on his bicycle, and Rooney watches him ride away. The old man turns to the window and waves to Annie as Sullivan walks out to the car. The driver holds the car door open for Rooney. Annie stares out at them from the kitchen window. Now, in the city, men enter a building with a sign that reads, O'Neill's. Inside, Rooney sits with Sullivan.
How is Michael? Is he okay?
I've spoken to him. He understands.
That's tough. Seeing that for the first time.
Rooney glances warily at him.
Well, you turned out.
Sullivan averts his gaze.
You can't protect him forever. If it wasn't this, it'd be something else.
Sullivan faces him.
Natural law. Sons are put on this earth to trouble their fathers.
Now, in a classroom, Michael grapples with a boy as students cheer him on. Michael wrestles him to the floor and punches him. Now, at Rooney's house, 10 men sit around a table.
John has also made it clear that Finn McGovern's operation will be divided up locally among two territories that John will select personally.
Sullivan sits alone at a table.
I'd like to take this moment to thank our friend Mr. Rance for interrupting a busy travel schedule to pay us a visit.
The speaker peers across the table.
Thank you, John.
Rance sugars his coffee.
Mr. Rance met with John and me earlier to make another bid for our involvement in the unions.
And I told Mr. Rance what I told him before. What men do after work is what made us rich. No need to screw them at work as well.
Is there any other business?
Yes. Connor, is there something you would like to say about last night?
The men face Connor, who sits at the head of the table opposite his father. From his seat, Sullivan gazes at Rooney's son.
I'd like to apologize for what happened.
Cigarette smoke wafts up.
Especially to you, Pa. 2 weeks in a month. What can I say?
Connor grins. Rooney stares tight-lipped.
We lost a good man last night. You think it's funny?
Connor's smile recedes.
Try again.
He stares at his father, past a decanter on the table.
I'd like to apologize.
Rooney pounds the table with his palm. The men flinch and turn toward him.
You would like to apologize? Try again.
Rooney stares down his son. His hands resting on the table, Connor rises to his feet. With trembling lips, he gazes at Rooney. Sullivan and Rance eye Connor.
Gentlemen, my apologies.
Several men avert their gaze and one works his jaw. Rooney sits with his hands folded. The gray-haired Kelly eyes the man across from him and nervously fingers a cigarette.
Is everyone clear about bit borrowers? There have been far too many debts outstanding.
Mike,
just give me the names. Tell me who to visit.
Thank you, gentlemen. Come on upstairs.
Rooney shuts his ledger book, gestures to Sullivan, and stands. One by one, the men collect their notes and get up, leaving behind their coffee cups and whiskey glasses. In his seat, Connor stares blankly ahead as the men file past. Rooney walks with an arm around Sullivan. Rance, Kelly, and the others turn into another room, followed by Rooney and Sullivan. Connor's steely gaze stays fixed ahead. Now at a chalkboard, a hand writes in childish cursive, "I will not fight with other boys." A nun sits at a nearby desk beside two other filled chalkboards as Michael continues to write. Nighttime. Sullivan, wearing his hat and overcoat, passes small piles of snow en route to his car. He enters the automobile.
Mike!
Sullivan rolls down the driver's window as Connor approaches from the house and hands him a note.
Dad forgot to give you this. It's just a reminder for Tony Calvino. Flight again.
Sullivan takes it.
Are you coming?
No, I'm under house arrest for a while. Look, I'm sorry about last night. Man. That was.
All right.
Sullivan rolls up his window. He drives off. Connor stares after him, his fogged breath hanging in the air. Now Sullivan trudges through the snow past a sign that reads, Pool. He descends a stairwell at the building's rear. A portly bouncer stands at the foot of the stairs.
Help you, sir, or just looking?
Here to see Tony Calvino.
Yeah, and who are you?
Light falls on Sullivan's face.
Mike Sullivan.
Yes, sir.
The bouncer stands before a door marked pool and billiards. Sullivan steps closer.
You gonna frisk me?
Should I?
It's a good idea.
The man pats Sullivan's sides, then reaches into his overcoat and takes away his gun.
That's the only one.
The fat man pockets the pistol in his coat and opens the door. Now in his room, Connor sits smoking and nervously checks his watch. Inside the blue-lighted speakeasy, Sullivan follows the bouncer. They cross a crowded dance floor.
Every night there's trouble.
A band plays on stage.
No one's got no dough, but all the world's here wasting it. Always money for frills and twists, never money for food. Sometimes I despair of the species, you know?
They enter a red-lighted room where scantily clad women lounge.
Number 12 in the beauty parlor. Who's the lucky face?
I'm not from here originally, but things being what they are, jobs ain't hanging off trees, you know? I'm a boxer by trade. 9 consecutive titles.
He draws back a curtain.
That's a record in South Orange.
They enter a hallway.
I'd make a pretty good bodyguard, I think. What I'm saying is Mr. Rooney looking for anyone? You know, anyone like me, for example? Is there any chance you might ask him?
Sure.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Inside a room, a dark-haired man snorts from the bottom of a glass.
Mr. Calvino.
The bouncer enters.
Mr. Calvino, Mike Sullivan's here.
Oh, shit.
He wants to see you.
Shit. Is he packing?
Not anymore.
Calvino clears drug right. paraphernalia off his desk.
Show me. Hey. You stick around, okay?
The bouncer nods. Calvino produces a revolver from a drawer, which he conceals underneath an open magazine on his desk. He tilts his head and affects a smile.
Hey!
Sullivan enters.
How the hell are you? Things good with the old man?
Yeah.
What brings you here? Don't imagine it's the pussy.
I have a letter for you from Mr. Rooney.
Am I behind again?
Sullivan shrugs as he passes the note over. Calvino yanks it from his grasp and grabs a letter opener.
Am I in trouble?
I don't know.
Calvino slits open the envelope and tosses the opener aside. He extracts a letter and turns his attention to it. Sullivan stares at him. As Calvino considers the note, his brow furrows. He glances toward the bouncer, then back at the letter as he strokes his temple. Sullivan shifts his gaze to the bouncer, who stares back vacantly. Calvino fixes his eyes on the letter, then on the desk. Sullivan follows his look. Atop the now vibrating desk, the opened pulp magazine begins to slide toward Calvino, revealing the gun barrel beneath it. The dance hall owner reaches for the revolver. Sullivan grabs it first and shoots him in the forehead. The bouncer reaches into his coat. Sullivan shoots him in the chest. He slumps against a wall and slides down to the ground. Sullivan grabs the note, which reads, "Kill Sullivan and all debts are paid."
Michael.
He picks up the telephone and frantically presses for a dial tone. Now at the Sullivan house, their telephone receiver hangs off the hook, dangling from an end table. In the bathroom, Annie towel dries Peter's hair. The door swings open, revealing the gun-toting Connor, who wears a muffler pulled halfway up his face. Annie shields Peter with her body. Connor aims the pistol as his eyes widen. Outside, Michael rides up on his bike. His eyes dart up to a flash of gunfire in a lighted window on the second floor of the house. Dropping his bike near a grove of trees, he takes off at a run toward the house. He approaches the front porch. Inside, Connor races down the stairs, tripping near the bottom. Outside, Michael stands staring through the front window at Connor's image in a mirror. Connor, gazing at his own reflection, lowers the muffler from his face, then smooths his hair. Out on the porch, Michael hurriedly slips away. Connor sighs, opens the front door, steps onto the porch, and puts on his hat. Michael stands nearby, hidden in the shadows. As Connor unbuttons his coat, Michael's chest heaves with ragged breaths. The killer pulls out a flask and throws back a swig. He stuffs the flask in his pocket and descends the porch steps. As Connor crosses the lighted front walkway, he glances briefly around, then continues on. Michael steps from the shadows and watches as Connor walks off through the snow. Now, inside the house, Michael hesitates at the foot of the steps. Upstairs, he slowly makes his way down the hallway. He glances into an open bedroom on his left. Up ahead, in his parents' bedroom at the end of the hall, a lamp sits atop a blue dresser. He steps slowly forward. The boy continues down the hall, then stops at a lighted door on his right, the bathroom. He turns and looks in. Staring downward and blinking, he enters the room. Outside, Sullivan's car swerves past the grove of trees, then stops. He gets out. Inside the house, Sullivan stares toward the kitchen table where Michael sits alone in the dark. They share a long look. Without blinking, Sullivan's anxious gaze darts upstairs. Michael follows his father with his eyes as Sullivan ascends the staircase. The boy stares blankly ahead. Now, Sullivan sits leaning against a wall, his face contorted in a pained grimace. Michael walks slowly down the upstairs hallway toward his father. With narrowed eyes and parted lips, Sullivan turns to look at his son. As their eyes meet, Michael stands with his gloved fingers interlaced. Sullivan blinks and hangs his head. Now at the Rooney house, Connor sits at a table as his father approaches.
I'm sorry.
Rooney tosses aside a chair.
Kid would have talked. I'm sorry.
Connor stands, cowering.
God damn you.
God damn you!
Rooney raises his hands and beats him across the back.
Fucking say you were born. I curse it!
Rooney grips Connor by his shirt sleeve. He pulls him to his feet. As he weeps, Connor turns his face away, holds up his hands protectively, then lowers them.
Oh, Lord.
Oh. Rooney embraces his son.
Oh, Lord. God help. God help.
Connor's arms wrap around his father's waist. Now Michael stands in the snow-covered yard holding a trunk. Sullivan steps onto the porch, suitcase in hand. He approaches Michael and crouches down.
This house is not our home anymore. It's just an empty building.
Sullivan steps away as Michael glances toward the house. Later, Sullivan approaches the car. His son sits in the back seat where Sullivan places his suitcase. He gets in. As the car pulls out, its headlights fall on Michael's snow-covered bike. Now they pull up outside the sprawling Hotel Florence. Sullivan parks behind the low-lying branches of a tree.
All right, you stay here. You stay out of sight.
Don't go, Pa. Don't go.
Michael.
Don't go.
Tomorrow when they find out we're gone, they're going to come after us. I have to protect you now.
Please, Pa.
Sullivan and Michael share a long look. The father's lips tighten.
Take this.
He hands his gun to Michael, who shakes his head.
I don't want it. No.
Michael,
I don't want it.
Take it.
I don't want it, Pa.
Boy, take it. You got 6 shots. If I'm not back in half an hour, you go see Reverend Lynch at First Methodist and you tell him what's happened. Do not go to Father Calloway.
As Michael reluctantly takes the gun, Sullivan gets out of the car. Now he ascends a fire escape, gun in hand. In a hotel room, curtains billow from an open terrace door. A lamp on an end table illuminates the room. Sullivan steps in, brushes past the curtains, and cautiously scans his surroundings. He stops at another door. Light strikes his face as he gingerly opens it. He stands in the doorway, staring at an old man who sits with his back to him.
I don't have any business with you, Mr. Kelly.
But I have business with you, Mike.
Kelly lifts a cigarette to his mouth.
Go ahead.
Sullivan enters. Kelly lifts a satchel to the table.
What is that?
$25,000. Mr. Rooney wants to know there's more if you need it. You have friends in Ireland, Mike. Why don't you take Peter and leave?
I can't take Peter. He's dead.
Kelly's eyes shift pensively as Sullivan approaches.
So where's Connor?
He stands by Kelly's side.
He's in hiding.
Where?
You know I can't tell you that, Mike.
Sullivan raises his pistol to Kelly's temple.
You think sticking a gun to my head is going to make any difference to me? If I tell you I'm a dead man anyway. We both are. Think, Mike. Don't be stupid. I'm just the messenger.
Sullivan's gun hand trembles. He lowers the pistol. Kelly turns away from him, his cigarette smoke wafting through the air. Sullivan looks off and nods.
Then give Mr. Rooney a message for me.
Kelly faces him.
What is it?
Sullivan glares, raises the gun, and aims it at Kelly's head. Inside the car, Michael holds the revolver in both hands, its barrel pointed away. He looks up suddenly as his father arrives. Sullivan takes a seat.
Give me the gun.
With a bloody hand, he pulls the revolver away from his son. The headlights of Sullivan's car illuminate an empty stretch of country road.
Where are we going?
To Chicago. There's a man there who runs things. I've done some work for him. You have to find out where he stands. Try to get some sleep.
Michael leans his head against the side of the car and blinks his eyes. Frowning, he stares out the window and his eyelids close. Daytime, the Sullivan's car continues down the empty road. Expanses of farmland extend in all directions. Farms dot the horizon under the hazy sky. Miles ahead, farmhouses and trees sit beside the long, straight road. Now the car passes through an empty crossroads. The two intersecting roads form four endless squares of flat land. Now Sullivan drives the car down a busy street. His gaze stays fixed on the car ahead. Michael sleeps in the back seat, his head leaning against the side of the car. Outside, crowds of people walk down the tree-lined street. In the car, Michael blinks his eyes open and gazes through the window. His eyes grow wide and he cranes his neck, staring upward. The green car joins other cars driving over a drawbridge. High-rise buildings line both sides of the street ahead. A train appears, traveling on a track over the road. Now, Michael and his father walk down a sidewalk crowded with pedestrians. Now, Sullivan and Michael walk inside a library reading room. Long rows of chairs are filled with people reading newspapers. Sullivan scans the aisles, pausing at the end of one. He puts his hand on Michael's shoulder.
I want you to wait for me here.
Sure.
I won't be long. You'll be all right?
Yeah, I'll be all right.
It's a good boy.
Michael inches down the row toward an empty seat, carrying his suitcase in front of him. He glances back, watching his father leave. Outside, Sullivan walks up a staircase, emerging at street level. Pedestrians pass by on the busy road. Sullivan stands at the top of the stairs, gazing up at a high-rise building. Now, inside a hotel, Sullivan walks along one side of an upper floor lined with thick columns. Ornate metal railings line a dining area that overlooks a large staircase in the center. In the foreground, two women sit at a table as a waiter approaches with a silver teapot. In the distance, Sullivan faces a wall of elevators. He walks across the brightly patterned carpet, approaching one set of doors blocked by two burly men.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, fellas.
It's nice to see you. We heard what happened. How you holding up?
I need to talk to Mr. Nitti.
He's awful busy.
One man pats him down.
I can wait.
Okay. Take the man to the top.
The elevator door slides open. Inside, an elevator operator watches as Sullivan and one of the men step on. The door closes, and the other guard steps in front of the elevator, clasping his hands. At the library, Michael leans forward in his chair, staring at his Lone Ranger book. The open pages show a drawing of the masked man holding a gun. He blinks back tears. With trembling lips, he drops his head forward. He lifts his head, blinking, as a tear rolls down his cheek. At the hotel, Sullivan sits alongside other men in a waiting room. He glances at his watch. In an adjoining office, a red light blinks on a secretary's telephone. She glances at Sullivan. He stands and steps across the smoky waiting area. In another office, a dark-haired man opens a door.
Sorry to make you wait so long, Mike. Come on.
He steps inside.
We all just heard what happened. Jesus, I'm sorry, Mike.
Well,
Thank you for seeing me, Mr. Nitti.
Come on, sit down. Would you like some coffee or...
No.
You sure?
Yes, thank you.
Sullivan sits in front of Nitti's desk. Nitti takes out a cigarette.
What can I do for you, Mike? I'd like to work for you.
Nitti lights his cigarette.
Well, that's very interesting.
And in return, I'd like you to turn a blind eye to what I have to do.
And what is that?
Kill the man who murdered my family.
Is one more body going to make a difference?
This is a good proposal, Mr. Nitti. I will work only for you, and you know I can do a good job.
I respect you, Mike. I do. And we would like nothing more than to have you come and work for us. But not like this. What you're asking me is impossible.
Is it?
Nitti smiles and flicks his cigarette.
Let me explain something to you that maybe you haven't realized. All these years, you've been living under the protection of people who care about you. And those same people are protecting you now, including me. So if you go ahead with this, if you open that door, you're walking through it alone. And all that loyalty and all that trust will no longer exist for you. And Mike, you won't make it. Not on your own. Not with a little boy.
You're protecting him already?
Nitti shrugs.
We're protecting our interests, Mike.
I drove all through the night to see you.
I appreciate that. Now I suggest you drive yourself back.
Sullivan stares at him, his brow furrowed. Nitti stands.
Go home, Mike. Go home and bury your wife and child. Without blessing.
Sullivan glares at him, then turns to leave.
Won't be that simple.
Nitti stands behind his desk, watching Sullivan leave the office. In the hallway, Sullivan walks toward the elevator with his head down. He glances at men sitting on a bench, smoking. As the elevator door opens, the guard follows him in. As the elevator doors begin to close, Sullivan slips out. The guard flinches as the doors slide shut. Sullivan walks across the hallway and opens a large wooden door. He exits into a bustling, ornate hallway. A bellman passes with a cart of luggage. Now, Nitti enters an office where Rooney and Connor sit.
Dad, listen to me. He's in the building. You can end this now. You gotta take him now.
Connor, get upstairs.
He glares at his father, then leaves. Nitti scratches his forehead.
God help me. God help me. What do I do?
You think objectively. And you make your choice. What would you do if Sullivan were just some guy?
Rooney closes his eyes and shakes his head.
God help me.
He looks up at Nitti.
Make it quick.
And the kid?
Oh, Christ. No, no.
One day the kid becomes a man? Think he won't remember?
I said not the kid.
All right. I know who to call. There's a guy who's done some work for us in the past. He's gifted.
Now, outside, a man walks toward us under an elevated train track. He carries a bulky camera, a black case, and a tripod. Now he walks up a crowded fire escape staircase outside an apartment building. He enters an apartment. A man is led away in handcuffs. A spotlight shines near the floor. The photographer follows its beam with his eyes, then takes money from his pocket.
2 minutes.
He holds it toward a police officer. The officer takes the money.
You got it, Mr. McGuire?
McGuire's 4x5 viewfinder shows the upside-down image of a heavyset man lying on the floor. Across the room, a knife juts from the man's chest and blood streams from the wound. As McGuire snaps a photo, blood streams from the man's mouth. McGuire leans around his camera, staring at the man. The man's chest rises. McGuire removes his hat and dabs at his high forehead with a handkerchief. McGuire stares at the gasping man, then glances over his shoulder. He puts his hat back on. Now he approaches the man, passing the handkerchief between his hands. At the man's side, McGuire crouches near his chest. He puts the handkerchief over the man's mouth and holds it. The man's body shakes, then grows still. A train car passes a row of windows on the wall above. Our view pulls away from the two men over the hardwood floor of the sparse apartment. Now in a dark room, McGuire develops a photo of the stabbed man. McGuire hangs photos up on a line that runs across the room. His head whips around as he hears the phone ring. He rinses off his hands, dries them with a towel, and heads for the door. McGuire disappears into a brightly lit room.
Harlan McGuire. Oh, good evening, Mr. Nitty.
Mm-hmm.
1600.
Framed photos of dead people hang on the wall.
$1,600 is my rate, Mr. Nitty. And what I make on the photographs is mine. No, never met him. But I know his work.
Hunched forward, McGuire leans over an end table. On a pad of paper, he writes Michael Sullivan.
He traveling alone? How old?
His pencil tip marks down a two-digit number, 12.
What do I do with the kid?
McGuire adds three lines to the number one, making a square.
Will do. Thank you.
Inside the square, he draws two X's for eyes and a frown for a mouth. Now in the green car.
You remember your Aunt Sarah? Your mom's sister? She lives in Perdition. She'll take you in.
Where is it?
Right by the lake. We went there once, all of us. When you were 4, maybe 5. It's beautiful. You remember?
The place with the dog.
Sullivan looks at his son in the rearview mirror. Now, in a cemetery, people in black gather before a casket. Wind blows dead brown leaves across the grass. A priest reads aloud from a Bible.
And at Peter, qui nos precessorum cum signo fidei, et dormiunt in sanctum.
Flowers adorn the coffin. In the front row of seats, Rooney sits next to a pale, thin-lipped woman. Other mourners stand alongside and behind the seats. McGuire stands in the crowd, gazing up at the sky. Now, Sullivan drives the car up to a white church with a high steeple. He and Michael walk up the steps and remove their hats before entering. The pale sky is streaked with yellow light. Inside, Sullivan kneels at a railing by the altar. The back of his head remains still. His bare neck shows between his short, dark hair and black overcoat. His brow furrows as he stares at a dozen candle flames. The glow lends an orange tint to his face. Sullivan's eyes dart left and right, then fix above the wavering tips of flame. At the back of the church, Michael sits in a pew watching his father. A crucifix hangs above an altar over an open Bible. The boy notices a basket of Virgin Mary figurines. Reaching out, he picks one up. The figure stands dressed in flowing robes, and her arms open out with her palms facing forward. Now, a man looks at framed photos of Sullivan and his family. The glass reflects McGuire's face. The photographer stares at a portrait, then walks away. In the nearby living room, the funeral mourners talk and drink coffee. McGuire heads upstairs. The pale, thin-lipped woman from the funeral walks toward the phone, which sits on a table under the stairs.
Hello? Mike. Oh, thank God.
We know, right?
okay.
Sullivan stands in a rustic lodge hotel.
We're on our way to your place, if that's all right.
Of course. I'll be back there in 2 days. How's Michael?
He's all right.
Deep lines mark Sullivan's forehead as he cinches his brow.
How was it?
Mike.
He stares off and tears fill his eyes.
We'll see you soon.
Sullivan hangs up. Sarah gazes off, still holding the phone earpiece. She hangs up. From upstairs, McGuire looks down at Sarah. As she gets up and walks away, he comes down and walks toward the candlestick phone. The hitman lifts off the cone-shaped receiver and dips the cradle.
Hello, operator?
Yes, sir.
I was just cut off. Could you reconnect me?
Daytime. The green car travels down a stretch of road, passing another car going the opposite direction. Alongside the road, headstones stand in a cemetery. Michael solemnly gazes out of the window. Behind the wheel, his father glances up from the road and looks at Michael in the rearview mirror. Now, in a rustic room with two unmade beds, a shadow appears on the carpet as a figure opens the door. It's McGuire. He steps into the room, moving toward a small table between the two beds. On the nightstand, he finds the Virgin Mary figurine. McGuire stares at it. Now, in dusky light, the green car drives down the highway with its headlights on and pulls into a diner parking lot. The diner, a small structure like a passenger train car, glows warmly on the flat, grassy farmland. Sullivan parks the car and faces his son.
You hungry?
No.
Might not be another diner for a while, so you should have something to eat.
I'm not hungry. I just want to read.
Sullivan looks away, glances back at his son, then gets out of the car. As he passes in front of the hood, Michael watches him. Sullivan climbs the stairs at the diner and walks inside. Meanwhile, a set of headlights emerge from the foggy night. They grow closer as the car moves up the road. Inside the automobile, McGuire sits behind the wheel. He peers straight ahead and spots the diner up the road. Three cars sit parked in front of it. Inside the green car, Michael lies asleep, hunkered down in the back seat. Passing headlights illuminate the crown of the boy's cap as the hitman pulls into the lot. McGuire parks. The glare of the headlights come to rest below a window where Sullivan's profile tilts in plain view. McGuire turns the headlights off and stares at the man. He notices a police car to his left, smiles to himself, and looks to the right. The green car appears empty. McGuire pulls the lapels of his coat together and moves toward the diner. Four automobiles in all now occupy the dirt lot. As he enters, the policeman and another customer look up, then go back to their food. McGuire sits in a booth, facing Sullivan. A waitress approaches.
Slow night, huh?
You kidding? This is busy. What can I get you?
You got a special?
Everything's special.
Is that so?
Everything except the food.
Everything except the food? You ought to be on the stage.
Don't I know it?
Sullivan stares.
Give me some of that honey-dipped fried chicken and a black coffee.
Duck soup?
Sullivan shifts uneasily. McGuire watches the waitress walk away, then faces Sullivan, who pulls out a flask. Sullivan sees McGuire looking at him and hides the flask.
Don't mind me, sir.
McGuire reaches into his pocket.
It's a free country. Used to be anyhow.
He pulls out a camera. Sullivan tips the flask in McGuire's direction.
No, thank you, sir.
At the counter, the policeman continues to eat. As McGuire takes out a roll of film and loads it into his camera, Sullivan watches.
Is that your profession or your pleasure?
Both, I guess. To be paid to do what you love. Ain't that the dream?
He sets his camera on the table.
I guess so.
Yourself?
I'm a salesman. Machine parts.
machine parts. That's wonderful.
I assure you it is not. So who do you work for?
Can you keep a secret? I'm press.
Which paper?
All over. I'm something of a rarity.
How's that?
I shoot the dead.
Sullivan stares blankly. McGuire cracks a smile.
Dead bodies. That is, I don't kill them.
I should hope not.
Always fascinated me, the look of them, you know? You ever seen one?
Yeah.
Sorry for you. Terrible thing. But it sure makes you feel alive, don't it?
As he stares at the hitman, a bead of sweat drips down Sullivan's cheek.
I'll drink to that.
Stuff makes you sweat, huh?
Sullivan nods.
Yeah. Piss, too. Excuse me, ma'am. Can you help me out here?
Sullivan pockets a knife and stands up.
Hey! Look out there.
Sullivan staggers and heads for the men's room. McGuire's smile fades as he watches his target step out of his sight. The hitman straightens. Now at the counter, the policeman stands to leave.
Thanks, Ruby.
Good night.
At his booth, McGuire calmly takes a gun from his coat and holds it under the table. He cocks the Luger pistol, then looks up to see the policeman re-enter the restaurant.
You got to leave a tip.
McGuire's gaze darts to the green car, which backs out of the lot. The hitman jumps up and runs outside. The knife sticks out of his tire. He points his gun at the escaping automobile. Inside, Michael looks out the rear window.
Get out!
Why? What's going on?
Get out!
A gunshot breaks the window.
Hey, what are you thinking?
McGuire shoots the officer, who drops. He shoots him again, then stares after Sullivan's car. Now, in the green car, Sullivan turns off the headlights as he veers off the one-lane road and drives onto plowed farmland. The wheels of the car kick up a cloud of dust as it speeds across the dirt. Sullivan parks. Sheared-off cornstalks lie in the vast field. He gets out and walks around to the other side.
Get out of the car.
He pulls Michael from the car.
Get out of the car. When I say get down, you get down. You don't ask questions. When I say we're stopping to eat, you stay with me. You listen to me from now on. You start taking care of yourself.
I can take care of myself fine. You never wanted me along anyway. You think it's my fault this happened.
Stop it, Michael. It was not your fault.
Michael turns to his father.
None of this is your fault.
Just take me to Aunt Sarah's.
I can't take you there. Not now.
Why?
He knows that's where we're going.
So what are you going to do?
Something I can't do alone. You have to listen to me now. Okay? Or else both of us are dead.
Michael nods.
I have to make Capone give up Connor. There's one thing Chicago loves more than anything, and that's their money. And they've got it. Banks all over the state. We're going to have to find it. And take it. Are you going to help me?
Yes.
Sullivan nods.
Then I have to teach you something.
Daytime.
Well, you know what the clutch is?
Sure, I know what the clutch is.
What is the clutch?
The clutch, it clutches.
Right, it clutches. Which of those pedals is the clutch? That's the gas. Gas. Show you. There. Right there, see? Here's the clutch, and it does the clutching.
With Michael at the wheel on a deserted road, the car jerks forward, then lurches to a stop. His father moves the gear shift.
Let's go again.
Release gas, clutch, shift gear, get gas, shift.
The car lurches and stalls again. Michael lays his head back on his seat as his father shifts them into park.
Can I make one suggestion?
No.
I'm doing this.
They stare at each other for a moment, then Michael sits up to the wheel again. Later, the car speeds down the road, weaving slightly. As they zoom past leafless trees, Sullivan eyes the speedometer.
45 miles an hour, that's a little fast. Look out for the tractor, Mike. Michael, look out for the tractor coming up now. Watch out for the tractor. Watch out for the tractor! Watch out for the tractor!
Michael swerves around it.
We made it.
Oh, yeah, we made it.
Sullivan stares ahead nervously. Later, Sullivan enters a bank carrying a black satchel. He walks past rows of tellers to the back, where a man in glasses stands in front of a clerk's desk.
No more excuses. I've told you once. Now I'm telling you again. Yes.
Excuse me? I'm looking for a Mr. McDougal.
Just one moment.
Well, this is a pleasant surprise. I wasn't expecting another deposit until the end of the month.
Actually, I'm making a withdrawal.
He draws his pistol.
I want dirty money only. Everything you're holding for Capone. It's off the books. Open the safe.
McDougal turns his chair to the safe.
You're insane. You know they'll find out who you are.
The name's Sullivan. You want me to spell it?
McDougal sets a metallic strong box on his desk.
Open the box.
They'll kill you. They're animals.
You don't say. Put it in.
McDougal puts bundles of money into the satchel. On the last one, Sullivan stops him.
Yeah. That's for you. Call it a handling charge. Tell Chicago I took it. But if I read about this in the papers, if I read about the savings of some innocent farmers being wiped out by a heartless bank robber, I won't be happy.
He grabs the satchel.
Good afternoon.
You really trust me not to say anything?
Always trust a bank manager.
McDougal stuffs the payoff into his jacket pocket as Sullivan leaves. The gangster exits the bank and steps to the curb. His green car inches up in front of him. Sullivan leans into his son through the open passenger side window.
There's no rush.
He climbs in. Now our view shifts to the right in a seamless montage of images. Outside Citizens Trust and Savings Bank, we look in through a window as Sullivan pulls his gun on the bank manager. Later, as Sullivan exits another bank, Michael pulls up on the sidewalk. Our view moves past a wall from the building's interior to the exterior as Sullivan climbs in and the car jerks forward into traffic. Now, McGuire sits in his apartment, rolling a coin over his fingers. At another bank, Sullivan exits with his satchel and Michael drives right past him. Back in McGuire's apartment, his long-nailed fingers shift the coin along his knuckles from thumb to pinky, then repeat. At another bank, Sullivan heads outside and chases down his car. Michael keeps driving as his father climbs in. Later, under a rickety carport, Michael and his father paint their automobile red. Sullivan opens the back door and lifts the bench seat. He drops his satchel in the money-filled compartment, tosses more bundles of cash beside it, and lowers the seat cover. Now at a restaurant, Michael and his father sit at the counter, eating. A waitress approaches.
Coffee?
Thank you.
She refills his cup, then eyes the father and son.
So what brings you guys to the middle of nowhere?
Bank robbers.
We're just passing through.
As the waitress leaves, Sullivan continues eating. Dark stubble lines his face. Michael turns to him.
So when do I get my share of the money?
Sullivan gives a sidelong glance toward his son as he chews.
Well, how much do you want?
Michael's eyes shift thoughtfully.
$200.
Chewing his food, Sullivan nods.
Okay, deal.
Michael grins as he piles food onto his fork. His smile fades and he turns back to his father.
Could I have had more?
You'll never know.
Michael's mouth hangs slightly agape. Behind them, two couples slow dance and a man sits alone at a table. Now in Rooney's house. Rooney sits still, ignoring the ring. Meanwhile, in a hotel room.
Come on.
Connor paces with a phone. Light flickers on Rooney's sober expression. Back in the hotel, his son shifts impatiently. Connor slams down the phone, overturns a room service tray, and heads out. Now in Nitty's office.
How much did they take?
He talks on the phone.
How much?
Okay, answer me this. What are we paying you for?
Connor barges in.
Where's my father?
What the fuck is this?
Why is no one talking to me?
Hold on.
I feel like a fucking prisoner.
I told you, you are not a prisoner. You are being protected. This is what your father wants.
I can look after myself.
No, you can't. This is the point. You're a big baby who doesn't know his thumb from his dick.
Fuck you.
Listen, Sonny. The only reason you're still alive is because you're John Rooney's son.
You're being a little short-sighted here, Frank. My father is an old man. I am the future. So don't you ever talk to me that way again.
Connor heads out. Nitty shakes his head, then lifts the phone receiver to his ear.
McGuire, do what you have to. Find them.
He hangs up, now at a bank.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sullivan. There is no money.
Sullivan draws his pistol.
No. I can get you money. I just... It won't be Chicago's. They took it all out 2 days ago.
Aiming his gun at the young bank manager, Sullivan leans in and glances out the office door.
Who authorized it?
The accountant.
What's his name?
Now in a hotel suite.
This is Mr. Rance in the bridal suite, and before you proffer your phony congratulations, there is no Mrs. Rance residing with me, and I'm all the better for it. Now listen carefully, because I am in no mood. I'm going to say this only once. I would like a boiled egg, and I want it runny.
Now on a wet street.
Pa, can you sleep in a motel room tonight instead of the car?
Yeah, that would be nice.
Sullivan's auto pulls up to a curb below a second-story window. Inside, fingers flip a coin from knuckle to knuckle. McGuire stands at the window, his other hand in his pocket.
How many more days are you going to want me, mister? Can we close the curtains? Even for a little while. I can't get no sleep with all that light.
McGuire faces a woman in bed. Below.
Remember, if you see anything, you hit that horn twice, and you don't get out of the car, no matter what.
Back in the suite, Rance cuts into an egg. Meanwhile, McGuire holds out some money to the prostitute. As she reaches for it, he playfully flicks his wrist away until she grabs hold.
Bye.
Back in the car, Sullivan loads his pistol, then turns to his son in the driver's seat.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Sullivan gives him a nod, then climbs out. Back in the suite, Rance dunks a slice of bacon into his boiled egg's stiff yolk, and it crumbles. Outside, Michael stares into his side-view mirror. Across the street, his father heads into a hotel lobby.
Yes, sir. Right away, sir. Runny.
Sullivan sees that the key is missing from the bridal suite mail slot and quickly heads upstairs. Meanwhile, McGuire stares out his window as the prostitute leaves. He eyes the Hotel Geneva across the street. In the bridal suite.
It's open.
He sits with his back to the door.
Top marks for speed, no marks for cookery. What, may I ask, do you call this?
Put it down.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Rance.
Sullivan points his gun.
How did you find me? This is the best hotel in the area. And you were so very particular.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Sullivan. May I ask you to lower your weapon?
Sullivan does as he asks.
Thank you. And what do you want?
Information.
Across the street, McGuire stops twirling his coin and watches Rance through an opposite window. In the suite.
I can't give you the files.
Sullivan raises his gun.
All right. They're in the next room.
As he moves across the suite, McGuire sees him pass by another window. Rance stops at an open doorway and points inside.
In here.
Bring it in.
As Rance heads into the room, Sullivan shuts a window curtain. Across the street, McGuire quickly grabs a shirt and throws it on.
I won't be able to see.
Meanwhile, McGuire pulls on a pair of suspenders.
What do you think you're going to accomplish by interfering with our business, Mr. Sullivan?
This has nothing to do with your business.
It's all business. That's what you fail to grasp. And in business, you must have something to trade. And you, Mr. Sullivan, have nothing to trade. Especially not for anyone as valuable as Connor Rooney.
I don't understand.
A ticker tape machine activates.
Opening bell on Wall Street.
Across the street, McGuire retrieves a shotgun.
Come on, open it.
Rance kneels to a trunk with a ring of keys.
Which one is it?
Meanwhile, McGuire hurries down a staircase. In the car, Michael opens his Lone Ranger book. As he reads, McGuire passes by his window. A car almost hits him. In the side view mirror, Michael sees the shotgun barrel poking from McGuire's coat. In the suite.
No, not yet.
Meanwhile, McGuire runs up the lobby stairs. Rance drops the ring of keys.
Better start over.
Sullivan aims at his head.
You got one more try.
In the hallway, McGuire cocks his shotgun. In the suite.
Oh, there it is.
He unlocks the trunk. It's empty. Rance flees to the bedroom. McGuire bursts in and fires. Sullivan ducks behind the trunk. Holes appear in the bedroom wall. McGuire ducks behind the sofa as they exchange fire. The force of a shotgun blast on the trunk knocks Sullivan backward. He shoots, and a lamp bursts in front of McGuire. Shards of glass rain on him as he collapses. Sullivan maneuvers on his back and kicks open the bedroom door. Blood trickles over McGuire's fingers as he grips his face. Sullivan crawls into the bedroom and finds Rance's blood-soaked body lying against the bed. On the other side are stacks of luggage, books, and boxes. Back in the living room, McGuire turns onto his stomach. In the bedroom, Sullivan checks the label on a ledger box and picks it up by its handle. He quickly escapes through a back entrance and runs down the hall. In the living room, McGuire crawls across the floor to a window. He opens it, then cocks a pistol. In the car, Michael shifts into reverse and speeds toward his fleeing father. Sullivan climbs onto the running board as Michael drives forward. McGuire fires again. Sullivan winces, then climbs into the car.
I'm okay. Just watch the road.
He clutches his bleeding shoulder as they speed off. In the hotel window, McGuire's bloody hand retracts. He drops his pistol on the windowsill and holds his face. As he pulls his hands away, he finds them soaked in red. As the sedan speeds down a country road, Sullivan holds his shoulder with a bloody hand.
Pa! Pa, are you okay?
Sullivan slumps over.
Pa! Pa!
Michael looks ahead. Off the road, he spots a farmhouse surrounded by trees. Michael slows the car to a stop and gets out. Waving his arms, he runs across a field toward the ramshackle house. An older man steps off the rickety porch as an older woman stares out at the approaching boy. Now a knife's blade glows red as a hand pulls it from a lamp's flame. Sullivan lies unconscious as the farmer holds his wounded shoulder. The farmer's wife stands in the doorway with her arm around Michael. A bloody bullet drops into a white cup. Later, Michael sits in a dark corner watching his father. Lying on his back, Sullivan twitches and shudders in his sleep, his hands clenching the blankets. Now, soft light from a table lamp illuminates Sullivan propped up in bed as Michael spoon-feeds his father. A thin mattress and pillow lie on the floor next to the bed. Daytime. Sullivan sits on the front porch, sipping from a coffee cup as the farmer's wife sits next to him, mending a piece of clothing.
When are you two heading out?
No, we've stayed long enough. We don't want to cause you any trouble.
The woman looks up from her sewing.
No trouble so far.
She looks out into the garden where Michael hoes alongside the farmer.
He's a good worker.
The farmer drops seed and pats it with his foot as the boy makes holes.
You have any kids?
No. We met too late. He dotes on you.
She turns back to Sullivan, who gives her a questioning look. She returns to her sewing.
You don't see it.
On the stretch of tilled earth, Michael looks over and waves to his father. Sullivan grins, and his son returns to hoeing the rocky ground. On the porch, Sullivan tilts his head thoughtfully as he watches the boy. Nighttime. A wooden mantel clock reads 2 a.m. In a dining room, Sullivan sits with the open ledger box in front of him. As he looks through the files, Michael steps into the archway behind him. Flames flicker in the fireplace as Sullivan looks over his shoulder at the boy.
Hello.
I had a bad dream.
You want to talk about it?
Michael shakes his head.
Well, come on in. Take a seat, if you want.
Sullivan points to a chair next to him. Michael walks over to the table and takes a seat. He watches Sullivan put away file pages under the light of a kerosene lantern.
Math, huh?
Yeah. I always hated it.
Me too.
As Sullivan sips from a cup, Michael rests his forehead in his hand.
So what do you like? What subjects do you like? Did you like? In school?
Michael shrugs.
Bible history, maybe?
His father furrows his brow.
Why?
I like the stories.
Sullivan nods slightly.
Peter was good at math.
Was he?
Michael nods as Sullivan stares off, his scruffy chin stubble catching the firelight. He reaches for some more pages, and Michael looks up meekly.
Did you like Peter more than me?
No. No, Michael. I loved you both the same.
But you were different with me.
Was I?
Michael nods again, studying his father's face. Sullivan furrows his brow and he shifts in his chair. He raises his eyebrows.
Well, maybe it was because Peter was just such a sweet boy, you know?
Michael lowers his gaze and looks away.
And you? You were more like me. And I didn't want you to be. I didn't mean to be different.
As Sullivan meets his son's eyes, Michael nods with a hint of a smile.
Okay.
His father nods curtly, his sturdy gaze locked on the boy. Michael stares at the tabletop, then gets up from his chair.
Night, Paul.
Good night.
Michael stops next to his father and hugs him, pressing himself tightly against his uninjured right shoulder. Sullivan awkwardly strokes the boy's elbow as it rests under his chin, then runs his hand up the boy's arm and pats Michael's shoulder. Michael releases and moves away. Sullivan gazes off blankly as Michael passes under the large archway and strides out. Sullivan returns his attention to the page-covered table. He stacks some papers in a folder and takes an accordion file from the ledger box. He holds the label close to the lantern. It reads, Mr. Finn McGovern, Accounts. Sullivan opens it and looks inside. He withdraws several folded pages and studies them. One reads, Alexander Rance and Associates. Another reads, Bank of Kankakee. As he flips through the receipts, Sullivan notices each is made out to Connor Rooney with various dollar amounts. Morning. Dressed in his gray suit, Sullivan jostles Michael awake from his mattress on the floor.
Michael, wake up. Get your things.
We're leaving.
Now the car pulls up to the front porch.
We left you something.
Michael waves with a bright smile as his father pulls away from the farmer and his wife. The old couple wave back and move off. The car speeds down the straight road between the fields, leaving a cloud of dust in its wake. The farmer leads his wife to a shady area between two buildings where the black satchel sits in the dirt. The farmer crouches next to it and picks up a notepad propped on the satchel. It reads, Thank you. The farmer opens the bag, revealing bundles of bills. The woman touches her husband's shoulder. Elsewhere, the sedan travels toward the rising sun on the flat horizon. Now, people mill toward a large red brick church with a tall steeple. Inside, Rooney kneels as the priest in green vestments places a communion wafer on his tongue. He makes the sign of the cross and stands. As Rooney walks away, another man kneels for communion. Rooney returns to a seat in the crowded church. A kneeling man, bowed in prayer in the pew behind him, raises his head from his folded hands. It's Sullivan.
Hello, John.
Rooney's eyes shift to his shoulder. Without turning, he moves his gaze around the church and smiles to himself. He nods.
You're a smart man, Michael.
I'm going to talk.
Here?
Downstairs.
Now, the men make their way down an old dark stairwell. Rooney hesitates, holding up his hand. A bodyguard following them backs off. As Sullivan reaches the church basement, he switches on the single row of overhead lights. The cavernous storage area is filled with cobwebs. At the far end, a stone statue leans against a brick arch support. Shutting the door behind him, Rooney faces Sullivan.
I didn't think I'd see you again.
Sullivan pulls Finn's folder from his trench coat.
Read this. Connor's been stealing from you for years.
He tosses it at Rooney's feet.
He's kept accounts open under the names of dead men. Men like the McGoverns. I stood there and helped him kill Finn to line his own pockets. I thought I was working for you. But I wasn't.
You think I'd give up my son?
He was betraying you.
Rooney scowls.
I know. Now listen to me. I tried to avoid more bloodshed. You wouldn't accept that, so I did what was necessary. But I've always loved you, like a son. And now I'm telling you, leave before it's too late.
Think. Now they're protecting him now, but when you're gone, they're not going to need him anymore. This ends with Connor dead, no matter what.
That may be. But you are asking me to give you the key to his room so you can walk in, put a gun to his head and pull the trigger, and I can't do that.
He murdered Annie and Peter.
There are only murderers in this room. Michael, open your eyes. This is the life we chose, the life we lead. And there is only one guarantee. None of us will see heaven.
Michael could.
Then do everything that you can to see that that happens. Leave. I'm begging you. It's the only way.
Sullivan straightens his shoulders.
And if I go?
Then I will mourn the son I lost.
Tears welling in his eyes, Rooney turns from Sullivan. As he walks back to the door and exits, Sullivan sadly looks to the floor. Nighttime. Rain falls on a deserted lamp-lit street. A red neon hotel sign is illuminated on one building. Inside a room lies Sullivan's closed rectangular case. He stares down at it, then places both hands on the top of the case, flips the latches, and raises the lid. The stock, barrel, and grips of a disassembled Tommy gun lie inside. Sullivan reaches down and grabs the barrel and receiver. Now he picks up the rear grip and clicks it onto the receiver assembly. Michael peeks around a half-open door and watches his father. Sullivan stands at a desk with his back to the boy. He lifts the foregrip and slides it into place. He hesitates with both hands on the Tommy gun, then turns around. Michael enters the room.
What are you gonna do?
Just one last thing, and then it's done.
Michael stares sadly. Behind Sullivan, a painted icon depicting Jesus and Mary hangs on the wall.
Go back to bed, Michael.
The boy glances off, blinking. He gazes up at his father and backs a few steps away. Michael turns and walks out. Sullivan returns his attention to the Tommy gun, which he holds with the barrel pointing up. Now he closes the lid of the gun case on its empty, form-fitting compartments. Later, at the desk, he writes the word Michael on the front of a crumpled envelope. Now he stands at his son's bedside, stroking the boy's hair. The shadow of steadily pouring rain plays across the wall beside Michael. Sullivan withdraws his hand from his son's head and lingers over him. He crosses to the door and opens it. He glances back toward his son, then shuts the door. Michael stirs in bed. He turns his head toward the door, pulls the bed sheets aside, and gets up. He walks to the desk, where the envelope stands, propped up against a reading lamp. Michael studies it. Now, in O'Neill's restaurant, half a dozen men in overcoats, fedoras, and caps head out. One guy holds the door for the others. Under umbrellas, they walk past a tall street lamp toward a car parked on the opposite side of the street. Rain collects on an awning near the restaurant, whose neon sign comes into view. Rooney, standing under a burly guy's umbrella, leads the procession of men. He taps on the window of his car, then pulls on the door handle. Inside, a man sits motionless in the driver's seat, with parted lips and blankly staring eyes. He slumps face down onto the steering wheel. Rooney slowly lifts his head from the window and peers off. With their guns now drawn, his men scan the area. Rooney surveys the other side of the street, where cars stand parked along the curb. One guy lurches as shots tear holes in his umbrella. In the distance, the muzzle flash of gunfire bursts forth. Unblinking, Rooney stands, staring downward. Muzzle flash continues, striking a man with a raised pistol. The burly guy returns fire. Another man with an umbrella gets off several shots, then bullets hit him. The burly guy lurches, struck, and spins to the ground. A bullet to the upper torso brings down another man. Smoke from firearms hangs in the air, and a fifth man topples back. Rooney stands stock still, his back to the gunfire. Five bodies litter the street around him. One still clutches a pistol. Another lies under an umbrella. In the distance, between parked cars and streetlights, a figure emerges from the shadows. As he approaches Rooney, he holds his Tommy gun, barrel down. Rooney grips the door handle in his clenched fist and shuts his eyes tightly. Rain collects on the downturned brim of his hat and trickles down in a straight line between his eyes. As the figure moves closer still, Rooney opens them. The figure stops behind Rooney. As the old man stares off sadly, the corners of his mouth droop. Now he slowly turns toward the shooter. It's Sullivan. They share a long, tight-lipped look. Shadows mask half of Sullivan's face.
I'm glad it's you.
His gaze leveled on Rooney, Sullivan raises the Tommy gun. As rain drips steadily from the brim of his fedora, his eyes glisten with tears. Rooney meets his gaze. Now Sullivan blinks sadly, then tightens his lips. As the green muzzle flash fades, Sullivan gazes down. Wisps of smoke waft through the air. He stares off with narrowed eyes, then lifts his gaze. A tear rolls down his cheek. In an upper floor of a nearby apartment building, a man leans out his window. In three lower adjacent windows, silhouetted people peer out of drawn drapes. On yet another lower floor, two people stand staring at him through translucent curtains. In the street, Sullivan lowers his gaze from the apartment to the splayed man at his feet. He lingers over the body, then turns and walks off the same way he came. Rain continues to pelt the motionless bodies. Sullivan walks into the shadows, half obscured by the foggy night. Now, in Nitty's office, the gangster smokes a cigarette as he talks on the phone.
I understand. But then Al wants your assurance that after that, it's over.
Nitty's eyes dart. His cigarette hand rests on a large opened book.
The Lexington Hotel. Room 1432.
Nitty hangs up. Now Sullivan approaches the entrance of a large concrete building. He steps through a revolving door, which is flanked by two doormen. Inside, Sullivan walks briskly through an empty lobby with oriental carpeting lined with potted palm trees. He rounds a corner and approaches a bank of elevator doors. A portly elevator man spies him and presses a button. The elevator door slides open. Sullivan gives the employee a curt nod, then steps in. Now, Sullivan walks down a corridor decorated with matching green carpet and wallpaper. He passes door after door. Now he reaches around inside his overcoat and pulls his pistol from the waistband of his pants. He rounds another corner, where a dark-haired man in a suit stands against a wall. As Sullivan approaches a half-open door, the man glances at Sullivan's gun hand and watches him enter. Inside the room, Sullivan heads toward a steam-filled bathroom and passes through its opened, mirrored door. He gazes down and raises his pistol. He lowers his gun and brushes the doorknob on his way out. The mirrored door swings forward, revealing Connor's body laying still in a freestanding bathtub. Blood stains the water, the lip of the tub, the floor, and the wall behind Connor's head. Sullivan makes his way back down the corridor. Now, he reaches inside his overcoat, replaces the pistol, and continues walking. Back at Sullivan's hotel room, Michael sits on a bed with his hands folded. In the corridor adjacent his room, light spills in as a door opens. Sullivan enters the corridor and steps through the shaft of bright sunlight. Now he rounds the corner formed by a thick wall partition. He gazes down, then lifts his head toward Michael. Grinning, the boy hoists himself off the bed and flies into his father's embrace. Sullivan cranes his neck, resting his cheek against his son's head. Michael's arms circle his waist. Now, Sullivan and his son drive along a dirt road. Michael leans out the passenger window, smiling broadly as his hair blows in the wind. Sullivan stares straight ahead, resting his elbow on the open car window. Now they drive through a hilly, wooded area. The car pulls to a stop at the base of a grassy hill. Nearby, dirt paths lead up the slope. Now Michael and his father walk through the sand at the top of the hill. Their feet slide as they make their way down the hillside. Patches of grass and trees jut from the sand. As they descend, they near the blue lake below. Our view pans over the calm blue water to the sandy shoreline. A lush, tree-covered hill lifts from the sand. In the distance, a small house sits at its base. Michael and his father walk side by side toward the weathered beach house.
Is that the house?
That's it.
Hey! I knew there was a dog.
Michael takes off running in the direction of the house, leaving a row of footprints in the sand behind him. Sullivan watches contentedly. He starts walking in the direction of the house, following the trail of footprints. Near the house, Michael runs across the sand. A golden retriever follows, stopping near the boy. He rustles the dog's fur playfully. Now Sullivan walks by the back deck of the house. Above it, a large window faces the beach. He edges up the hilly earth beside the house, then ascends the staircase to the door. He walks in.
Sarah? It's me, Mike. We're here.
He walks down a hallway, then into a whitewashed living room. Sheer white curtains frame the large picture window on the far end of the room. As he stands at the window, our view of him blends with the reflection of the rippling water below. He gazes outside. On the beach, the dog stands on its hind legs as Michael rustles the fur behind its ears. Their images reflect in the window where Sullivan stands. Sullivan's gaze follows the boy as he runs on the sand. Blood bursts from Sullivan's chest. He wavers and slowly crumbles to the floor. As he falls, McGuire becomes visible, sitting on the far side of the room. Sullivan drops below the window, and McGuire stands, picking up his camera tripod. He walks slowly to the center of the room. He places his pistol on a table and unfolds his tripod. Below the window, Sullivan writhes on the floor with his back toward the wall. Blood covers the front of his white button-down shirt. McGuire kneels and looks through his camera. The viewfinder shows an upside-down picture of Sullivan on the floor. Near the windows, Sullivan's legs tremble. As McGuire leans over his camera, bright sunlight reveals dozens of tiny cuts covering the left side of his face. Sullivan winces and blinks his eyes against the flash's bright light. McGuire turns with a start. Behind him, Michael holds a pistol. He stares at McGuire, pointing the gun directly at him. McGuire stands from his crouch at the camera and stares at the boy. He grins for a moment, then his smile fades. Michael's arms tremble as he holds them rigid in front of him. McGuire lifts his hand.
Don't you do this. Give me the gun, Michael.
From the floor, Sullivan shakes his head.
Come on. Give me the gun.
Our view closes in on Michael's tight-lipped face. McGuire falls to his knees, then collapses face down onto the floor. Michael holds the pistol tightly. His surprised gaze shifts to his father. Sullivan holds a pistol, then drops it to the floor.
I couldn't do it.
Michael rushes over to his father and kneels by him. He cradles Sullivan's head in his hands.
I'm sorry.
Michael rests his hand on his father's cheek as he stares down at him.
I'm sorry.
Sullivan's eyes close. His head falls limply to the side. As Michael loosens his grip on his father, Sullivan's head slumps to Michael's lap. Michael shakes his father's shoulders. He grips his father's shoulder, gently rocking his arm. He shakes a bit harder. Grimacing, Michael runs his hands through his hair and doubles over. He rests his elbows on the floor between his father's outstretched arms. Sullivan's hand still grips his pistol. Our view pulls back from the boy. In front of him, the camera tripod stands on a carpet in the middle of the whitewashed room. Sunlight shines through the large window as Michael crouches near his father. McGuire's lifeless body lies outstretched in the foreground. Now, Michael stands alone on the shore, gazing at the sunlit lake with his hands in his pockets.
I saw then that my father's only fear was that his son would follow the same road. And that was the last time I ever held a gun.
The image of Michael fades away into sunlight. Now, Sullivan's car travels along a country road surrounded by fields. The farmer's wife stands on her porch, painting the weathered house. Her husband stands on the roof. They pause, watching Sullivan's car park nearby.
People always thought I grew up on a farm. And I guess, in a way, I did.
Michael and the dog walk toward the house.
But I lived a lifetime before that, in those 6 weeks on the road, in the winter of 1931.
The dog races over the grass, silhouetted in the bright sunlight. Michael follows, carrying a small suitcase.
When people ask me if Michael Sullivan was a good man, or if there was just no good in him at all, I always give the same answer. I just tell them, he was my father.
Michael strides up the grassy slope toward the house as our view fades to black. Now credits appear, based upon the graphic novel written by Max Allen Collins and illustrated by Richard Piers Rayner. Music by Thomas Newman. Costume designer Albert Wolski. Film editor Jill Bilcock. Production designer Dennis Gassner. Director of photography Conrad L. Hall, ASC. Executive producers Walter F. Parks and Joan Bradshaw. Produced by Richard D. Zanuck, Dean Zanuck, and Sam Mendes. Screenplay by David Self. directed by Sam Mendes. Cast in order of appearance. Tyler Hoechlin as Michael Sullivan Jr., Rob Maxey as drugstore owner, Liam Aiken as Peter Sullivan, Jennifer Jason Leigh as Annie Sullivan, Tom Hanks as Michael Sullivan, Paul Newman as John Rooney, Daniel Craig as Connor Rooney, Sharon Hines as Finn McGovern, Craig Speedle and Ian Barford as Rooney's henchmen, Stephen Dunn and Paul Turner as Finn McGovern's henchmen, Kathleen Keene, Brendan McKinney, Jackie Moran, Kieran O'Hare, and John M. Williams as Irish musicians, Nicholas Cade as Boy Michael Fights, David Darlow as Jack Kelly, Dylan Baker as Alexander Rance, John Sieros, John Sattler, Michael Brockman, John Judd, Christian Stolt, and Jack Callahan as Rooney's business associates, Maureen Gallagher as Michael's teacher, Kevin Chamberlain as Frank the Bouncer, Juanita Wilson as brothel maid, Doug Spinoza as Calvino, Roderick Peoples and Keith Kupferer as Nitty's henchman, Leroy Rogers as secretary, Stanley Tucci as Frank Nitty, Jude Law as McGuire, Kurt Nabig as tenement murderer, Lance Baker as crime scene policeman, Monty as living corpse, Dwayne Sharp as Father Calloway, Diane Dorsey as Aunt Sarah, Michael Sassone as motel manager, John Sturchy as cop at diner, Robert Jones as farmer at diner, Laura Phillips as Ruby the waitress, Harry Grainer as Mr. McDougal, Job Cherney, Lawrence McGowan, Timothy Hendrickson, and Marty Higginbottom as bankers, Mina Beatty as Betty the waitress, Ed Cross as young bank manager, Heidi Jane Netsley as prostitute, Phil Ritterelli as hotel manager, Peggy Roeder as Farmer Virginia, James Green as Farmer Bill, associate producers Cheryl Ann Martin and Tara B. Cook, art director Richard L. Johnson, set decorator Nancy Haig, set designers David Tenenbaum and Carrie Sanders. And thanks to Anthony LaPaglia, City of Chicago, Illinois Film Commission, Chicago Film Commission, Charles Dawes House, Evanston, Illinois, the Evanston Historical Society, Northwestern University, City of Geneva, Lone Ranger Comics, courtesy of Classic Media Incorporated, and all at the Donmar Warehouse Theatre, London. Songs, Whose Honey Are You, written by Fred J. Coots and Haven Gillespie, performed by Ruth Etting. The Irish Mazurka, performed by Hugh Gillespie. There'll Be Some Changes Made, written by Billy Higgins and W. Benton Overstreet, performed by Chicago Rhythm Kings. Old Torn Petticoat, The Reel of Momentum, performed by the Irish Musicians. Perdition, piano duet, written by John M. Williams, performed by Tom Hanks and Paul Newman. Sidewalk Blues, written by Walter Melrose and Ferd Jelly Roll Morton, performed by the Orbert Davis Sextet. Everybody Loves My Baby, written by Jack Palmer and Spencer Williams, performed by Sharky Bonanno. Queer Notions, written by Coleman Hawkins, performed by Fletcher Henderson and his orchestra. Someday Sweetheart, written by Benjamin Spikes and John Spikes, performed by the Charleston Chasers. Alma Redemptoris Mater, performed by Choir of King's College, Cambridge. Copyright 2002 DreamWorks LLC and 20th Century Fox Film Corporation, all rights reserved. DreamWorks LLC and 20th Century Fox Film Corporation are the authors and creators of this motion picture for purposes of the Berne Convention and all national laws giving effect thereto, and for purposes of copyright law in the United Kingdom. The characters and events depicted in this photoplay are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. This motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries. Unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution. Distributed by DreamWorks Distribution LLC, DreamWorks Pictures. This film has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH with funding from DreamWorks Pictures, described by Justin Soule, Nikki Zada, Christopher Flowers, Matthew Christofferson, and Allison White. Read by Pat Lentz. For more about description, call DVS at 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website at access.wgbh.org.